This is the February 6, 2014 edition of WFAE Talks. I'm WFAE News Director Greg Collard, and I'm joined by education reporter Lisa Worf, who has had quite a busy week.
It has been a busy week. Another State Board of Education week and charter stuff to look at. So it's been a fun week.
Yes, and some late nights, too.
Yeah.
All right. We'll get into that.
I'm glad for the week to be wrapping up.
We'll talk more about that in a bit. We're also joined for the first time by one of the new additions to the WFA newsroom, Gwendolyn Glenn.
Hi.
You seemed a little nervous when you were asked to participate in this podcast.
I was a little.
You were a little?
Just a little.
You don't know what to
but
expect.
I'm okay.
Yeah.
Are you a little bit more at ease now?
Well, already I'm going to try to be or fake it.
Okay, fake it. All right, good. I like the answer. First, before we get going here, one announcement. We have a public conversation next Thursday. It's called End of Life Planning and Choices. It'll be at the Wells Fargo Auditorium at the Levine Center for the Arts next Thursday from 7 to 8:30. That's Thursday, February 12th, and you can go to our website to register for that event. So, Lisa, you started the week off by addressing some of the troubles that some charter schools have been having. There's been a few that have closed in the Charlotte area in the last year, and you tried to look into what the heck is going on.
Yeah, there's been three charter schools in Charlotte that have closed in the past 10 months, and they didn't even make it through a year. So the last one to just have closed was Entrepreneur High School. And so, yeah, you know, one of them closed back last April, and then Concrete Roses closed. And after each one of them, you know, by the second one, you know, we kept on saying in the newsroom, what's going on? And then Entrepreneur closed. So it was, you know, I went through some of the applications and looked, you know, at some of the questions they were asked and, you know, what folks were saying you should ask. And, you know, basically trying to figure out what the common denominator was here. And there's a lot of different things that go into the closures of all these three schools.
There's no common denominator.
Well, there is a low enrollment.
Okay, right.
Is a common denominator. You can say mismanagement too, but it's difficult, you know, if you're not getting the students you expected to get because, you know, funding follows students. So you're, you know, a couple of these schools, they got less than half of the students that they expected. So their budget was less than half of what they expected. And that just creates big problems. Mm-hmm. So, you know, kind of looking at, you know, how do you try to get around that? Because really there is not, it's hard to figure out, you're a new school, how many students you're going to get. I mean, and, you know, I talked to people who have reviewed lots and lots of charter applications and they say, you know, coming up with a market for education is so difficult. But one of the ways around this guy with NACSA, I feel like I've mentioned him recently before, is the group that represents people who authorize charters, mm-hmm. who basically give them a go-ahead or tell them they have to close down. And he said, you know, the question that should be asked is, you know, okay, if you don't get the expected enrollment, how are you going to change your plans to make this thing work?
Gwendolyn, you covered education where you came from in Baltimore, public
yes.
radio station. What are the call? I'm awful with call letters. The call letters again in Baltimore?
WYPR.
WYPR, okay. Did you cover charter schools there? Were there a big deal there?
I did, and charter schools were big there. And it was a big push of the former superintendent. That was something, one of his priorities. And you have lots of charter schools in Baltimore. They have about 80-something thousand mm-hmm. students. But that has not been a problem getting students.
Oh, really? So there's always a wait list. Yeah.
They have, because a lot of them, maybe some are focused on social justice issues. Uh-huh. Some are, they all have these, you know, just wide range of what they're focused on. And they seem to get the students. Their problem has been in terms of students being up to the same level as other students in terms of performance, academic performance. And that's where, and some of them in terms of they each year decide who's gets renewed and who gets so maybe a 1 year or maybe probation or your license gets pulled. And a lot of it has been for reasons of mismanagement, but academics has been a big thing that some of them have not been.
Just not delivering.
Their charters, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Can they pull?
They have the students, but
yeah,
sometimes they're not up to par academically.
Can they pull a charter for academic reasons up there?
They have. And,
okay.
And actually, some have been well known. There was this one school, the Johns Hopkins University, held the license, and they voted to close that school. And when they do vote to close, the parents are very upset.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
a big uproar. The school board meetings are packed, and people are very upset because they're very attached to these schools.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, with charter schools, how they get approved and how they, you know, get pulled, it's different in every state.
Have there been any closed in North Carolina for academic reasons? I know there was one that might have, there was pressure for one to close, and it ultimately did. But you really don't hear about, we haven't had that many.
They can close them. It's somewhat recent. And there was one, it was a school that I looked into in Gaston
right.
County, Highland. And the state was on the course to close them because of academic reasons. I think it was the third year in the row. They didn't make growth and didn't have a certain score. But then they ultimately decided to relinquish mm-hmm. their charter. So, and you know, this is another thing that I didn't get into the look at this week with the charter school closings. But one of the things is that, you know, we have had a cap for so long. And, you know, basically you either didn't approve any schools over that, you know, something like a decade-long period or longer than that, or you had 20 groups competing for one charter because a school got out. So there is an argument that, look, we're just learning this process all the way over again.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a learning curve here. And, you know, we also do have a new board that has not been approving as many as the previous board.
Is there a feeling among this board that maybe we were going a little too fast at first once the cap was lifted?
I think there's, you know, I think Student First that closed last April was mm-hmm. a little bit of a wake up call to some people on the board that maybe you know they should say no more if they get a feeling that it's not going to be successful instead of letting it go through, that they should be basically tougher.
Yeah. Well, speaking of charters, another different kind of charter school is approved this week. Actually, two of them, online charter schools, K-12 and what was the other one?
Connections Education.
So we have two online charters operated by for-profit companies that are going to be up and running next school year.
They are, yep. So August is when they can open. And so they could each open with 1,500 students in August.
Taken from anywhere in North Carolina.
Taken from anywhere in North Carolina. And there was some debate about what to require of these schools before it was approved this week. You know, for example, they are going to require for students who can't afford you know, a computer, for example, which is key if you're going to mm-hmm. go to an online virtual charter school, the companies will have to provide that.
Well, Gwendolyn, you started here in January, early January, and this week you had one of the first stories you went into, you dug into concerned gangs in the town of Chester
yes.
In South Carolina. And it was a long, you spent a lot
nice
of time looking into this.
To begin
yes.
with.
How did you get stuck? How did you get stuck doing this story? I don't know. Aren't you supposed to be? You start off with some easy stuff. How did you do this from right off the bat?
Well, actually, when we talked about it, I was interested in it,
right.
Because I had not very familiar with Chester, but I knew of some problems that Chester has mm-hmm. over the years, and this goes back many, many years. And I also knew of a nearby county where they were saying they were having problems in their schools because some of these students who had gotten suspended or expelled mm-hmm. from school were being sent by their relatives
right.
to nearby Fairfield County, and that they were causing a lot of problems in those schools, and those schools were saying they didn't want these students. So, yes, I was interested once.
So it wasn't just me saying, you go ahead and do this investigative story right away, I guess is what okay, that wouldn't. But no, I appreciate you being inspired to attack a story right off the bat like this. So what's a takeaway from this? Is it pretty scary? You hear about gangs in a small town and people being shot, and city councilman was killed in a drive-by shooting last fall. I mean, when you were there, did it seem like a kind of an eerie place to you?
It did to me. Mm-hmm. And I'm not very familiar with Chester. So I did this ride along with a sheriff's deputy, and he took me everywhere in some of the historic areas, to downtown areas, to all of these neighborhoods where they're saying these gangs are operating. And the message they had was that they are in every neighborhood. Either they live there or they're causing problems there. And it was because at times we were on dark streets, and once it got dark, seemed like a lot of these young guys were out on the streets, and we were driving through. The sheriff's deputy was a former gang member himself growing mm-hmm. up. Hmm. So he felt very comfortable, and they know him. They know his background, and he knew a lot of these guys by name. But at one point, when there was a heated discussion between the deputy and this guy who's in a neighborhood, the Roundtree Circle neighborhood, mm-hmm. which is one of the gangs that they say that's causing most of the problems there, and he said, this is a store where it was a beer, wine, convenience store where they hang out.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were out of his SUV, and this heated discussion, the other guys are going by, and it's dark, and not being familiar with the area and knowing that we were in the middle of what's considered a gang area, mm-hmm. it was a little uncomfortable.
Okay. It was interesting listening to some of the raw tape you had, and you just listening to these people telling you about the problems, and are some people conflicting or having conflicting views of having
if it's a problem,
if it's a problem,
or
whether
not
it's a problem
at all,
people disagreeing about whether it's a gang problem. There's a gang problem in Chester, and and people are pretty, some people are pretty defensive about being labeled a town with gangs.
They are. And I would say, though, what struck me, and which I was not surprised by, is that a lot of people did not want to talk about it mm-hmm. out of fear of retaliation. And so they didn't want to say it was a gang problem. They would say these things happen, you know, houses are shot up, and or somebody, you know, people are being robbed and break-ins. And they know who these gangs are, because Chester is not that large. The county is 33,000, and the city itself is about 6,000 people. So this is a place where everybody knows everybody. They know who they are, but they, especially elderly people, they are not going to talk. I had a pastor who said, a lot of my members live in the city. My church is in the county, and a lot of them have been victims, but they don't want to talk about it because some of them live by themselves. These gangs will break in their homes. They may not have alarm systems, that kind of thing. And even in a barbershop where I was, one lady actually ran out when I started asking questions. And they were looking at each other, say, wow, she got out of here quickly. But she wanted nothing to do with any discussion of gangs. Uh-huh. And this particular barbershop, Frogs, was in the Brooklyn section of Chester. And that's where a lot of the gang activity and incidents have happened. Mm-hmm. So another person who was in said, don't, she was looking at me as if to say, don't ask these questions here, mm-hmm. and then have them come down on us and retaliate against the barbershop. She said, don't bring that in this barbershop. So it was, that was something that I ran into a lot. People did not want to talk, and especially not on tape.
But it sounds like you got, you know, quite a few people to open up to you.
I did in getting some who said, yes, this is a big problem. And then you had those who, as the gentleman in the barbershop, he was like, these are just some bad kids. He felt like, yeah, these things are happening, but, you know, it's the parents' problems. They don't want to, you know, because a lot of them are teenagers. These are not all adults. A lot of them are 14 and 15-year-olds. And you, as the law enforcement officer said, it's in all the schools, even the middle schools, the elementary schools, you're having, you know, some, and they said some of them, their parents, who are the older ones who are gang members, and they're bringing their kids right along with them. But a lot of them are the younger kids. And one of the things they said, the main problem is that there's not a lot for these kids to do in Chester. Not a lot of recreation. The parks are small, and, you know, it's not enough for them to get involved in. So a lot of them become involved with the gangs who take them under their wing. And there are also female gangs. They're not all young men. There are also young females who are involved in gangs.
What I found also really interesting about your story was, you know, when you mentioned that a lot of these kids were sent down. Their parents may be living, you know, in the Northeast, and they send their kids down to be with their grandchildren. And that's something, like, I've heard so much around here. You know, I always hear, you know, about you know, but it's interesting in Chester how that's kind of played out, that they, you know, the parents in the Northeast, up north, want to kind of protect the kids, and they send them down here.
And some of them are living with, say, for instance, a grandparent, and they are hoping that they're going to be able to turn their lives around. And some, and then I ran into some who have gotten their children out of Chester. The young 16-year-old who was killed on the streets in July, his parents had him moved. He was in another school. He was home visiting for the summer when he was shot in the street, shot and killed.
So sad.
Yeah.
Well, Gwen, let's a little bit about you. You're from South Carolina.
Yes, I'm originally from South Carolina, and my mother still lives there. My sister, brother, lots of relatives, and I came here from, I was working with WYPR in Baltimore, but living in Silver Spring, where I also have lots of brothers and sisters, aunts and uncles. That's my second home.
and you're a graduate of Winthrop College.
Yes.
Or university.
Yes, Winthrop University. I went to Winthrop University for undergrad and studied journalism. I went for a year at USC to study journalism, working on my master's degree. And then I decided after that first year, I would I took a job in television for a CBS affiliate. And I did that. I had worked in radio for a commercial station in Columbia as well.
Then you worked at NPR over in the Baltimore Sun Media Group and different things.
I did because, and along the way, after I left television, I worked for a year on Capitol Hill for U.S. Senator Howard Metzenbaum. And that was when I started actually working for NPR, because I would leave the Senate, go to NPR, and I was a freelancer. I was doing a show called Horizons. They were half-hour reports, so I was doing Horizons reports, and then the specialized audience module services. Those were smaller reports. Frank Tavares was over the department, used to be the voice of NPR.
Right.
And so that's when I started working for NPR, and I did that, and then I went to grad school to complete my degree. And I was still freelancing for NPR while I was in grad school.
Well, we're glad to have you here, and hope and you're starting to do some other stories now. You did a really interesting one on the Friendship Nine, and
that was a powerful hearing to cover, and I was really glad I had an opportunity to cover that. That was the Friendship Nine. They were students 54 years ago, and they staged a sit-in at an all-white lunch counter in Rock Hill, South Carolina. They were arrested and sentenced to 30 days working on a chain gang. And they decided they had a choice, pay a $100 fine or 30 days on the chain gang. And they decided that, you know, that $100 is funding what they considered was a racist government. Mm-hmm. So they just said, no, we're going to take the chain gang 30 days. And it started the jail no bail strategy for the civil rights movement. It was just an experience to meet them. Only one of them only one passed away. His son was there. And it was just something to just hear the courage in their voices and to hear their stories and their emotional stories, and talking about what they went through and that experience working on the chain gang. And they also had a sit-in while they were on the chain gang because one of them had asthma, and he went to a hospital. They didn't know where he was. They were afraid that he might never show up again. And when they couldn't get answers on where he was, they just staged kind of like, I'm not working. And they were doing hard labor. They wouldn't work. So they were all put in solitary confinement. And they said that what happened was under the door, somebody, they would get bread and water and they refused to eat it. So somebody slipped a Baby Ruth bar under the door, and they said, and they were big then, the bars. Right. That can't, so they said a good thing it was because they divided into eight pieces, I guess, because one was not there. And that's what they ate in solitary confinement until they found out what happened to their friend. So they were very courageous, and there was a standing ovation when Ernest Finney, who was the first African-American Chief Justice of the South Carolina Supreme Court since Reconstruction, walked into the room, 80-something years old. He's 83 or 84. He was the same attorney who represented them 54 years ago. Wow. He was there that day and got a standing ovation when he walked into crowded courtroom.
Imagine, yes, there are multiple times where you just had chills.
It really was. And it was, you could just feel the energy in the room. Everybody was so intense in that they were listening to every word. Bernice King, Reverend Bernice King, Dr. King's, Martin Luther King's daughter was there as well. And it was, people were lined up early to try to get a seat in that courtroom. A lot of them were not able to. They had two overflow rooms, the council chambers, and also another room that could hold 150 people, and they were both filled as well. It was very, very powerful.
Good stuff. Well, Gwendolyn, thanks for all your hard work you've done so far. And you're going to be next week be covering the Greg Hardy trial.
Yes, and that's sure to get a lot of national attention. And of course, Greg Hardy, Carolina Panthers defensive end, who was found guilty of assaulting his girlfriend in an earlier bench hearing,
right,
and now he's appealing that sentencing in a jury trial.
Yes.
So it starts on Monday.
All right. Lisa, Gwendolyn, appreciate your time, and have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Same to you.
All right.